You're with us for the morning show as we check in on stimulus deal negotiations on Capitol Hill. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The final remains of the CARES Act expires in 13 days, and the question is, how does this next stimulus relief package differ from the first one President Trump signed nearly 9 months ago? And will it be enough? Will it be enough to help frontline workers, to help unemployed Americans and businesses weather those difficult winter months ahead? Your questions about this roughly $900 billion deal and the politics surrounding it, we're at 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's nice to be with you.
Well, today is supposed to be the big deadline, right, for lawmakers to resolve all of their disagreements, their battles, and to pass matching bills in the House and the Senate. And then there's the critical government funding bill in the mix. Can you sort this out for us and bring us up to speed?
Well, so let's start with the government funding issue. This is actually a hard deadline of midnight tonight to get a stopgap funding bill passed. If that doesn't happen, and we've been down this road before, it would initiate a partial government shutdown Saturday morning. So that's kind of a must pass piece of legislation. And it's happening at the same time as lawmakers are trying to pass the first, you know, sort of COVID stimulus package since this past spring. So both these things are happening at once. They're hoping to get them both done today, but there's certainly a very good chance that, you know, the stimulus package, the COVID package could carry over into the weekend. Both could carry over into the weekend, but, the first line urgency is on getting the government funding package passed as kind of a stopgap to avoid a partial government shutdown.
Okay, and this would be the third stopgap spending bill, if I'm counting right. I mean, they keep kicking the ball down the road.
Yeah, it's not the first. Again, we've been down this road before. Congress is not functioning at a high level right now. It hasn't been for some time. This has all been playing out in the middle of a presidential election at a time when there's pretty narrow margins of control in both chambers, and a time of divided government and a time of, you know, deeply polarized political landscape. So all those things have made it harder to get these things done, even routine things done.
So as you look at what is being crafted for this next stimulus deal, what are the most vexing issues where lawmakers really need to find some compromise, find some common ground on this deal?
So certainly the size of the package is an issue. Democrats have been pushing for a bigger package and Republicans have been pushing for a smaller package. There's also the issue of direct aid to states to help them weather this crisis. It's something that Democrats have really pushed for. There's a lot of resistance among Republicans to that. So that's, you know, maybe the single biggest sticking point in all of this. We're also, you know, this isn't, you know, this debate isn't entirely transparent. So we're just sort of relying on, you know, we're not watching this unfold before our very eyes. So like a lot of people, I'm sort of relying on what I'm hearing from other sources on this, but you've got a reported effort by Republicans to limit the financing power of the Federal Reserve when it comes to responding to this crisis. And then you've got, you know, sort of related issues, obviously all the fine print about, you know, who's eligible for the stimulus checks and what the criteria are for that. And I'm sure there's a number of other kind of second order and third order issues out there.
We have the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert. He's bringing us up to date on the stimulus package negotiations that are unfolding on Capitol Hill and the latest on the critical government funding bill that has to be addressed as well with Friday today, midnight, the deadline. You can join in with your questions about what you see in these negotiations. What will Congress do? Join in at 800-642-1234. You know, Craig, there has been certainly talk about what these stimulus checks might look like, who might be eligible. Do we have any inkling about what is being hammered out in terms of the size and who would get such stimulus checks?
Well, just to break down the package a little further, I mean, one component would be more than $300 billion in small business assistance. We're also talking about money for vaccine distribution, jobless aid, which was in previous packages. They're talking about sort of 10 weeks of jobless aid in the COVID crisis. And then $600 stimulus checks. But what's, again, we don't know with certainty is, you know, how many people would get those checks and what the eligibility requirements would be.
Are there signs that our economy is deteriorating here in these final days of the CARES Act? What are some of the economic signals that we're seeing?
Well, there are signs. You know, this has been a really, really bumpy road, and there have been times during the pandemic when it looked like the economy was, you know, roaring back from the body blow it took in the spring. But some of the indicators have flattened in recent months. And so there is a lot of concern, obviously, among office holders and policymakers that that the situation, you know, is fairly dire, and that is fueling certainly a lot of the urgency to get something done.
You know, the Paycheck Protection Program was such a huge thing for businesses in the first CARES Act. There's also been in the second round a lot of clash from lawmakers over, you know, money being perhaps given to theaters or music venues or restaurants. And do we have any indication here that those entities would get more support this round?
Yeah, there is support, and it's not, it does, you know, that support isn't entirely limited to one party. I mean, obviously, there's more support on the Democratic side for the kind of aid you're talking about. But there are Republicans on the Hill that also support doing something, you know, for a range of groups. It would include, you know, theaters, museums, obviously restaurants. So there's certainly a potential to find some common ground on that front. Again, you know, against the backdrop of some overarching differences between the two parties over how big any aid package should be.
What is the view on the eviction moratorium that will sunset here at the end of the month?
I'm not really sure.
Yeah. So as you know, if they work on this through the weekend, then and they are able to pass another stopgap bill so that they can keep working on this, how closely linked might be the stimulus bill with the government funding bill? I mean, should you be mixing those two?
Well, sometimes these things, you know, sometimes the hard deadline in one case can help spur lawmakers to get the other thing done. Uh-huh. Obviously, there's these two things don't have to be done at exactly the same time. But I think when you have sort of dual deadlines, I think that adds to a sense of urgency. And I think it creates a will on the part of lawmakers to just, you know, get the whole thing done rather than, you know, we're heading into the holiday season. Obviously, the government funding gap measure has to be done. But I think they want to get both things done because the longer, you know,
they won't want to draw this out. Right. I want to pause there with Craig Gilbert, who is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Checking the WPR.
You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're checking in on Capitol Hill, where lawmakers are racing to complete a relief package deal. So the prospects are agree on a stimulus deal as part of a sweeping government funding bill, pass a third stopgap spending bill so negotiations can continue over the weekend and further, or let the government shut down at midnight. Where do you stand on this? What should lawmakers do? It's 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, are all of those scenarios then in play?
Well, I think there's going to be a stopgap funding measure. Okay. Whether it happens today or tonight or, you know, tomorrow, I think it's going to happen. And even if there's a very short-lived partial government shutdown, I don't think the impact will be dramatic if, again, if the bill is taken care of this weekend. I think there's also a high expectation that the stimulus will get done too, even if it could drag on a little bit longer. Obviously, that's a more complicated piece. And there, as we've talked about, there are kind of lingering stalemates on some issues there. So so I think we'd be surprised if this thing just sort of blew up and was unresolved going into early next week.
We want to get your take on Senator Ron Johnson's Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, the hearing Wednesday, and the conspiracy theories and the whole undermining the Biden victory. And we have some of the tape.
This is not disinformation, this hearing today. This is getting information we have to take a look at to restore confidence in our election integrity. We're not going to be able to just move on without bringing up these irregularities, examining them, and providing an explanation.
Okay, so he brought no specific evidence. What did you take away from what Johnson was saying?
So I talked to Senator Johnson the day before his hearing, and in that interview, he said that he basically accepted Joe Biden's victory as legitimate and the election as legitimate. He accepted the results nationally and in Wisconsin. While he did have, while he did believe there were irregularities, I mean, his position is basically, you know, there's always some level of fraud in these elections. It's just, it normally doesn't rise to the level of actually altering the outcomes. And he said, I haven't seen anything that would alter the outcome in this election. So that was his overarching position. But at the same time, you know, he held this hearing, which did become a platform for, you know, some of the, you know, claims, some of them more outlandish than others, that the Trump campaign and the president and his supporters have made about the election being stolen, the election being illegitimate, the election being fraudulent. And so there's a spectrum of issues here that did get aired out at the hearing. You know, most of the witnesses, again, there were several witnesses, state level witnesses that were from basically, there were advocates of the president and his campaign that were part of efforts to overturn the election results in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Nevada. And again, a spectrum of claims being made that some Republicans just sort of, kind of accept under the umbrella of these are irregularities. But on closer inspection, they turn out to involve, you know, in many cases, election procedures that have been in place for several years. And have been in place when Republicans control the election process in states like Wisconsin. So, on the Republican side, you've got, you know, Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky kind of blithely asserting the election was stolen at this hearing without foundation. And then you've got, you know, Senator Johnson, who's accepting the results of the election, but making arguments, but sort of accepting the premise that there was a level of irregularity and a level of problem that I think goes beyond certainly what the courts have found.
Obviously
are issues related to election procedures that, that can be ironed out, but that's a separate question.
Yeah, it got heated at times. Was Johnson challenged for doing this, for holding this hearing?
Well, you know, there's the context of all this gets pretty complex. And it, again, the most heated moment came over an issue that was only indirectly related to the subject of the hearing. And that was sort of Russian disinformation. It had to do with Johnson's own investigation this year into Hunter Biden, mm-hmm. Joe Biden's son. you know, an investigation in which he was accused by Democrats of being sort of, you know, kind of promoting Russian disinformation. He was sort of burning over that claim and it got triggered by some things that were said at the hearing, and he lashed out at the top Democrat on the committee, Michigan Senator Gary Peters, and he lashed back. But it was pretty emblematic of kind of the real bitter acrimony surrounding these election issues, you know, which again extends back to, on the Republican side, their grievances about the investigation into President Trump, and Democratic grievances about the investigation into Hunter Biden, and all the ill will over this election itself.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert. He's bringing us up to date on the politics on Capitol Hill. What is the most pressing need for Congress to address now? What would help you more, a stimulus check or unemployment assistance? Join in at 800-642-1234. So, Craig, I'm wondering, did the cyber attack that we learned about this week, which is becoming much bigger than at first blush, did that come up in the hearing at all, or has that been talked about even more so this week on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, it didn't really come up
okay.
in a central way in the hearing. Mm-hmm. And again, I should mention too about this hearing, this was Senator Johnson's final hearing as chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. Whatever happens in the Georgia elections next month, which are going to determine control of the Senate, whether the Senate Republicans are in the majority or the minority for the final 2 years of Ron Johnson's second term in the Senate, the Republicans term limit their chairman. And so his time will be up as chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. He'll probably, if the Republicans retain control, be a subcommittee chairman of the Committee on Investigation. So we'll continue to see him doing investigations and chairing some hearings, but he won't have the profile that he's had in recent years as chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. But with respect to the question you asked, you know, it didn't really figure in a significant way in this hearing. And it's just, you know, it's sort of unfolding. It's hard to sort of evaluate the impact it's having right now on Capitol Hill. But okay. As you said, you know, as the scale of it becomes increasingly clear, I think we're going to see a lot of fallout.
Earlier this month, the Texas Attorney General had filed the lawsuit seeking to overturn election results in key swing states, including here in Wisconsin. It was tossed out by the Supreme Court, but not before more than 100 members of Congress had signed on in support. What do you think the long-term effect will be on that move?
Well, interestingly, there was only one, if I'm not mistaken, one member of Congress, one Republican member of Congress from Wisconsin who signed on to that effort out of, the five House members and the one senator on the Republican side. That was Tom Tiffany, who represents northern Wisconsin. That's the seat that was once held by Sean Duffy.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't get a lot of support from Wisconsin Republicans. Again, this has been kind of a little bit of a fault line on the Republican side, but in terms of how far they want to go in, you know, kind of following down the road that President Trump has carved out when it comes to making, you know, sort of sweeping baseless claims about a stolen election. But I think it's gonna, you know, it, I think it's left certainly a pretty bitter wake. And these election fights have a way of kind of compounding and escalating. And, you know, it's pretty sobering, I think, when you think about, you know, whether this signals, you know, more future post-election fights over elections, which normally don't happen unless we're talking about, you know, a few dozen votes deciding the outcome of an election. But if that threshold gets raised to several thousand votes, which normally haven't been enough to sort of trigger these kinds of, you know, furious post-election fights. They have happened in the past, but it seems like we're lowering the bar now. So I think that's a pretty sobering signal in the future. And we're certainly going to have a lot of close elections in our future.
You know, I mean, you've been covering Congress, Capitol Hill for so long. I'm just wondering, as you look at the incoming Biden administration, how do you think they will do in this type of climate that we're seeing now with the bickering and the infighting and the inability to find consensus?
So I think Joe Biden sort of sees himself as, you know, a pragmatist and, you know, a kind of moderate liberal. And I think he sees himself as someone who could, you know, find some common ground and get things done. But I think it's going to be extremely difficult because, you know, for all the reasons we've talked about, you know, the distance between the two parties, the pressures internally within each party, and also just the thin margins of control. I mean, we're talking about a U.S. Senate where, you know, two runoff elections in Georgia on January 5th are going to determine, you know, which party controls the Senate. And if it's the Democrats, it's going to be a 50-50 Senate. That's where control is going to be decided by the, you know, the vice president's vote.
Lots to watch for. Craig, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're discussing a new report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum that looks at the effects of declining state revenue for higher ed and the multi-year UW tuition freeze. Last week, I asked UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank whether the freeze should be lifted.
Yes, that's an easy answer. Look, we've had 8 years of a price freeze at the university. If you compare us to our peer schools, you know, whether Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, the schools that are right around us, all of them over the last 8 years have seen something between a 10 to 20% increases in state tuition.
Is the UW losing its edge? What is holding it back? 800-642-1234. Mark Sommerhauser is Communications Director and Policy Researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Mark, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and we also have your colleague, Jason Stein here, Research Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, focusing on state and local government. And Jason, you were lead researcher on this report called Falling Behind? The State of Wisconsin's Public Universities and Colleges. Jason, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Well, Jason, let's start with you and more of a 30,000-foot view, if you will. What were you able to identify when it comes to some higher education enrollment trends in here in Wisconsin?
Well, if you look at the enrollment trends in Wisconsin, and we can talk about the finances as well. It's a difficult trend nationwide, but it's even more so here in Wisconsin. So we've seen for our public colleges and universities roughly a 13% drop in enrollment since its peak in 2011. And, you know, at some institutions like UW-Madison, there's been modest increases, although that doesn't keep up with its peer public research institutions nationally. But other institutions, particularly two-year institutions, are seeing double-digit decreases in enrollment on a full-time equivalent basis, even larger than 20%. And this is greater than the declines nationally.
Yeah, I'm wondering what is going on there? What factors are contributing to these technical college enrollment drops?
Sure. Well, if you just look at the overall enrollment drops, one thing to say is that during the 2000s, we did see enrollment growth. So the problem doesn't look quite as bad if you look back 20 years instead of looking back 10 years. But it's still a problem, obviously. One thing that we're seeing is that in recent years, you simply don't have as many students completing high school in Wisconsin as you used to have. And so that's obviously the traditional pool of students that universities and colleges draw on. We've also seen some decline in enrollment rates. So in other words, of the students that do graduate from high school, some decline in enrollment rates. And so both those things contribute to fewer students being in our post-secondary institutions.
And with fewer students come fewer tuition dollars with that. I mean, those two go hand in hand. What do you see there? Your report shows that Wisconsin ranks 41st in the nation in higher ed revenue and last in the Midwest.
Right, right, exactly. So first off, as you rightly point out, for there to be any tuition dollars at all, there's got to be a student there, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the first challenge, is having the students there. And then the second challenge is, for at least from the standpoint of the colleges and universities, is that there is a tuition freeze that's been in place. Since 2014, we've frozen tuition in Wisconsin, in-state undergraduate tuition, to 2013 levels. We found in the case of UW-Madison that tuition freeze has kept net tuition and fees the third lowest among a group of 35 peer public research institutions. And of the ones that had decreases or lower increases in tuition, we're typically seeing a large infusion of state funding, state tax dollars, to help buy down that tuition. That's not the case for UW-Madison. So those are some of all the forces that are piling up on our higher education system.
Mark, as you look at these forces that are piling up, how do we, our state funding levels for higher ed in Wisconsin, compare around the nation, compare to our neighbors?
Yeah, well, I think as you referenced, looking at total revenues, both from state and local funding, as well as tuition, our system has declined comparatively nationally from being sort of middle of the pack, 24th highest in 2000 to 41st in the nation here most recently in 2019. We also have gone from sort of a middle of the pack status within our Midwestern region in 2000 to being last in the Midwest in 2019. So those are kind of some of the numbers that we go over in our report.
Yeah, we're talking with Mark Sommerhauser and Jason Stein. They conducted research at the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum, and they're walking us through the new report that looks at the state of Wisconsin's colleges and universities and the funding status of them. You can join in with your thoughts. What questions do you have about how our state's colleges and university budgets operate? What would you like to know about the effects of the UW tuition freeze? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jason, you know, talking about this tuition freeze in place at the UW, why did it happen in the first place?
Sure. And that's a great question and an important thing to highlight. So during the 2000s, we saw very substantial increases in tuition. And, you know, in many ways, the tuition freeze was a response to that, as well as to the fact that the balances or reserves from tuition dollars that the UW system had built up continued to increase during the Great Recession and during a time when tuition was going up. And so there was a feeling on the part of state officials that there needed to be some policy to respond to that, and that was the freeze. Now, what we have seen since the freeze was put in place is that tuition balances, or the sort of, again, reserves or net assets that are left over from those tuition dollars, those dropped by nearly 60% between 2013 and 2020. So one thing that had the effect of was providing fewer reserves to the universities of the state to confront the COVID-19 challenge.
Yeah, I'm wondering, those depleted tuition reserves certainly would probably impact your ability to respond to any crisis, whether it's a pandemic or otherwise. What is a healthy balance of tuition reserves? Where should they be?
Well, it's a good question. Right now, again, it's in the sort of 8% range for the system as a whole, but there are some individual campuses that are much higher than that. There are campuses, including UW-Madison, that are lower than that. So that's one important thing to note, is that it's not uniform across all the campuses in the system. I mean, certainly when you look at reserves as a share of spending, for many units of government that we look at in our work at the forum, whether that's school districts or state government or city government, we typically like to see reserves in, you know, a double digit percentage as a share of spending. It does matter by individual institution, mm-hmm. what they're doing. So if you're going to cash finance some kind of building project or some other type of capital outlay, then you're going to need more tuition reserves. Obviously, if you're a university that you feel you're at particular risk of losing students to enrollment declines, you may need more tuition reserves. And if you're in, you know, you don't have some of those things, you may feel you need less.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's a key part of being prepared for unexpected events. And as we see with COVID-19, those can happen in a big way.
Mark, you looked at how universities that are similar to UW-Madison, how they've managed tuition freezes, sometimes voluntary freezes. How did their situations play out differently from what we've seen here in Wisconsin?
Sure. Yeah. And I think Jason sort of referenced that earlier. But, you know, one of the interesting things was that we did find, a handful of peer universities to UW-Madison that have enacted, either tuition freezes or actually tuition reductions here in recent years. But there was an important distinction, which I think Jason highlighted, and I'll just go back to again, which was that, you know, in the case of those other institutions, typically that tuition freeze, where that amount of tuition revenue was stagnating for that institution, was backfilled by an increase in state funding. That essentially backstopped or allowed those institutions to buy down tuition. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a distinction that we saw between, in the case of UW-Madison, obviously that has not been the case during that period that we looked at.
And you were looking at schools like Purdue and University of Washington, Seattle, and in Florida. Yes. So you were looking all over the country.
Yes, that's correct. In the case of this comparison, as well as some of the other comparisons that we did in the report, we were able to, using some national data, to select a group of 34 other peer universities. These are other sort of premier public research universities throughout the country. And that gave us a nice pool of sort of comparable universities to compare with UW-Madison.
In order to understand what's going on here, is it important to have that comparison going on to finding out what's happening outside our borders?
We certainly felt so. I mean, frankly, that was, in our minds, one of the important elements of the report. It's easy with these conversations to sort of get in the silo of just comparing within the state, within the past to the present and so forth. And we wanted to sort of give a more of a national view to compare both the system in UW-Madison to other public universities around the country.
The Wisconsin Policy Forum's Mark Sommerhauser there, Jason Stein here as well. They're breaking down their new report on the state of higher ed funding in Wisconsin. Do you work at a university or a technical college? What changes have you noticed? Do you or a family member attend a college or university in Wisconsin? What can you add about the financial health, the investment in your institution? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with researchers Jason Stein and Mark Sommerhauser of the Nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum. Their new report, it crunches the numbers on state and local funding revenue streams and tuition revenue trends over time and what effects this is having on our state universities, technical colleges, especially amid the pandemic when financial strains are intensifying. Gary from Iron River called in, couldn't stay with us. And Jason, Gary would like to know how our state spending compares on a relative basis in higher ed and not just on a gross basis. Where are we compared to other states?
Sure, that's a good question. So, you know, Mark mentioned before, when we look at revenues from tuition and from net tuition and from state tax dollars, our overall higher education system in Wisconsin ranks in 2019 41st on a per student basis for funding. Now, one important caveat is that arguably that data, that national data, should include certain local property tax revenues that technical colleges collect. And so we also did a version of that where we adjusted it. And again, we were still below the national average in that case as well. And in both cases, you had a trend in which we were falling from, you know, toward the middle of the pack nationally or upper, depending on how you looked at it, to below the national average. And that's also true within the Midwest.
What did you find in terms of the levels of research funding?
Sure. So that was another important part of this report. When you look at research spending, and the vast majority of it happens in Wisconsin, in within the public universities at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Since 2010, when the federal survey was changed, you've seen a 17% increase in research R&D spending at UW-Madison. So that's greater than the rate of inflation. The difficulty is that when you look at all institutions, that increased 29% nationally. So in other words, Wisconsin still is ranked pretty highly, eighth in the nation for R&D spending. But in 2010, we were ranked third. Mm. And so, you know, on the one hand, we're still ranked above Harvard, which is, I think, a feather in our cap. On the other hand, you know, Harvard more than doubled its research spending since 2010, and UW-Madison only increased it by 17%. So again, you know, it's not like it's in free fall or anything like that, but it isn't keeping pace with other top institutions nationally.
And certainly research dollars, so important, the grant funding to keep these labs open, to keep them functioning and of course, furthering the research. But they employ quite a few people.
Right. I mean, it's important on a couple levels. I mean, one, when you're talking about $1 billion of funding that comes into the state, it's an important in an economic development sense in its own right. And then in addition, obviously, these are dollars that are going to create innovations. They lead to patents. They lead to developments that can spur on new companies and innovation within our economy and lead to further growth down the line. So it's an important consideration when we think about what is our higher education system in the state accomplishing.
Mark, for people who aren't fully connected to the Wisconsin college or university system or attend one or work at one, what should these numbers, these trends that you saw around the nation and here in Wisconsin, how would you translate that? How would you make this hit home?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, our higher education system in Wisconsin obviously has a legacy and a tradition of being an outstanding one. It's important both at the basic level of, you know, just providing a post-secondary education for Wisconsin, you know, high school graduates, but also at a level of attracting people into our state, a lot of whom come here to get a very high quality of public, you know, post-secondary education. And then, of course, as we just discussed, I mean, the research element is, you know, primarily relating to UW-Madison, but that's a tremendous you know, economic driver for our state and for the Madison region. And I think it is pretty clear that, you know, while we see, and as Jason mentioned, we see research spending growing at UW-Madison, but just not at the pace, you know, to match some of its peer institutions around the country. And that's kind of what we're seeing in a lot of these areas is whether it's UW-Madison or the UW system, you know, a process, especially over the last decade of, as we say in the report title, falling behind some of its peers within the Midwest and across the country.
We're talking with Mark Sommerhauser, Jason Stein. They wrote a recent report about Wisconsin's colleges and universities. It's called Falling Behind. You can join in on what you see at your local college or university in terms of its health, its viability, 800-642-1234. Jason, another spoke, if you will, of this whole funding is endowments, right? I mean, UW-Madison sits on an endowment that's over $3 billion, not nearly as much as Michigan's endowment. But where do alumni funds and endowments stand in this?
I mean, it's an important question. Certainly in the case of UW-Madison, that's a significant driver that it can turn to in terms of funding its operations. And we didn't look in deeply to that issue. One thing that's worth noting, however, is that, you know, some other institutions like UW-Milwaukee don't have that same endowment. And so certainly as we think about how we can move our university system forward at the state level in a difficult situation, trying to build up endowments for other campuses around the state and continue a healthy endowment for UW-Madison is clearly a part of how we try to move forward thoughtfully and strategically.
Well, let's turn this to solutions based on your data gathering here and the interpretation. Where do you see solutions?
Well, I mean, let's look at it big picture. Obviously, state funding is an important part of this, but given the effects of COVID-19 on the state budget, the goal may be more about limiting pain in the short term than actually reinvesting, which is what you would hope to see in the long term. There's obviously other priorities like pandemic response, healthcare for the needy, and other social services, and also, you know, keeping taxes manageable in a difficult economic time. You know, at some level, the state can consider what to do about tuition. There are a lot of ways to handle the challenges before us. Obviously, right now, the UW system is not seeking a tuition increase. But there is, you know, there's been bipartisan support for having that freeze in place, but there's also been some bipartisan questions about it in the last couple of years. And then we can also look at other ways potentially to make college affordable. So it would certainly be possible to let tuition increase for those who are able to pay it, but also provide additional financial aid so that low and even middle income families have assistance as they try to take on the difficult task of paying for college. So that's just a few of the things to consider, and we can go on.
Mark, as you looked around the country, were there any solutions adopted at other universities that you looked at or some things that we could bring here to Wisconsin?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that our report looked so much at solutions around the country as we did sort of comparing some of these fiscal metrics. But, you know, listen, I think that the potential solutions that could be on the table for policymakers, and obviously, you know, we should add that we're a nonpartisan organization, we're not an advocacy organization, and we're not, you know, suggesting any particular course of action. Mm-hmm. But Jason went over some of the potential solutions, and it's you know, it's frankly not a terribly long list. I mean, you know, when we look at funding for the system, most of those dollars come from either state appropriations or tuition. And, you know, the big exception, of course, being the research funding, much of which comes from the federal level. But those are kind of some of the you know, revenue sources for the system that have to be looked at. Now, we did also look at some other things that could be done potentially to give additional flexibility to UW-Madison and things like budgeting and procurement and borrowing. So there are some things that could be done there, but you know, most of those big revenue sources are the ones that I just mentioned.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Jason Stein, Research Director, Wisconsin Policy Forum. Mark Sommerhauser, Communications Director, Policy Researcher. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.